Mr. Robert Breedlove, glad to have you on the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast, recording in this beautiful studio here in Bitcoin Park in Nashville, Tennessee. How's it going today?
It's good, man. Really glad to be here. And this is a quite beautiful setting.
Yes.
For a good conversation.
I don't want to have a conversation anywhere else now.
It's ruining us on normal places.
So let's get started. Again, obviously, Thank God for Bitcoin is a fairly new business. You've been a part of it. You've been a part of the book. But for the people who don't know you, people outside the Bitcoin space, tell us about yourself. Tell us how you got here.
Yeah, okay. So my name's Robert Breedlove. I grew up in Tennessee, actually. So we're in my homeland right now. I grew up about 2 hours south of here in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I would say I was raised Southern Baptist, but kind of had a bit of a split in my family where my mom was less about getting me into church every Sunday. She was fine with me going, but I also spent a lot of time with my aunt and my uncle growing up, and they were very, very diehard about going to church every Sunday. So depending on, you know, how we're spending our time, I would either be more or less involved with church going up. But then getting into like middle school, I started to really love youth group, you know, largely just about the girls and having fun and the trips and all that. But definitely got very involved there. And then, but at the same time, I always talk about my reading journey. I was starting to read really hard books when I was like 11 or 12, specifically astrophysics. And so I had this materialist, atheist, reductionist viewpoint kind of growing inside of me at the same time. And I think by the time I was like probably 15, 16, I was pretty much atheist internally. I just thought it was all a nice fairy tale for communities to organize themselves around. But the truth was atoms and Big Bang and, you know, all of that. That's a bunch of BS now, I guess, in retrospect. But I started getting into yoga in my early 20s, and that got me into meditation later, which got me... I was also reading Eastern philosophy at the time, so I was kind of going down that rabbit hole. And so I guess I started to become less materialist, more spiritual through that process. And I was a practicing yogi for about 12 years, about the age of 21 to my early 30s. I'd like to get back into it, by the way. So plan on doing that. And then I had somewhat of a meditation practice throughout. So that was, again, getting me back on the spiritual path. But it was funny enough, not until getting into Bitcoin, which is the whole story there, obviously. But discovering Jordan Peterson through Bitcoin. My business partner at the time was big on his books, big fan of his book, 12 Rules for Life. Other people I had run into, I just kept hearing this guy's name. Like, you should check out his lectures, check out his lectures. And finally, I was like, okay, what's this all about? As someone that doesn't consume a lot of audio or video content, I mostly like to read. And so I went and watched his YouTube lecture series, The Psychological Significance of the Bible. And wow, everything that I was not getting, I guess, in the church growing up that was making me think it was just a subjective fairy tale, Peterson approaches it completely differently. He takes kind of a science-first approach from multiple angles. And I would say he's kind of establishing consilience on the idea of God. Like Carl Jung always separates God, which is inherently ineffable, eternal, beyond language, logic, speech, and the idea of God, which is our, we try to have some symbolic relationship with God, as I understand it, or the sacred. And we have to obviously use a word for that. So we say the idea of God. And I guess Peterson's work is really bridges that gap between science and religion, for myself at least. And now, much more difficult to say where my views are now. It's, you know, we often talk about praxeology in Bitcoin circles, which is the study of human action. Praxis meaning action, so praxeology being like the science of action. Action meaning the purposeful use of means to achieve ends. And that gets into like all the work of Mises and Rothbard, Hayek, and all these guys. That's a like a subjective rationalism, I would say. And then we have something more like objective rationalism, like mathematics, right? You have certain axioms and we deduce from there to get something very potent like mathematics. It seems like So economics in the praxeological sense is very new, not new. It's old, but we're still kind of in the dark ages. Like the world's dominated by Keynesian economics, not Austrian economics, which is, I hate that we even have to use that modifier. Yeah. And it's just actual economics and bullshit central bank propaganda effectively. But it seems like maybe the Bible and other texts like that were kind of speaking to this praxeological domain. It's like we've observed how humans are across the longest spans of history.
Yeah.
We've isolated all these individual stories, and you abstract out kind of the principle or spirit from those many stories, and you abstract again. And in this process of abstraction, you end up with an archetypal story like the Passion of Christ. And this is where people like get so divided, because they're either on the historicity of Christ. It's like, did he exist? Yes or no? And was he God? Yes or no? But I have this position on it. It's like, you could take all that and completely throw it out. Completely just toss it aside. I'm not here to argue about theological aspects of Christ or even the historical, like did he exist or did he not? Don't even need to argue that. All you need to recognize is that the Christian story, the story of Christ, has become embedded in the substructure of our culture. Like, that's inarguable.
Mm.
If you go and read the Western canon, right, the most influential works of literature of Western civilization, the first one is the King James Bible.
Yep.
So, and a lot of my thinking on this is influenced by this book, Inventing the Individual, which I would say I'm still absorbing, so I'm not going to maybe speak to this perfectly, but the thesis in that book is that pre-Christ, we didn't even have a conception of the individual as such. It's like you were just a unit in a family. Families were attached to the land. Land was attached to the ancestors. Like, there was not this individualized, atomized economic actor, conscious actor with free will and self-determination. Wasn't really a concept pre-Christ. So Christ kind of, by being part of our mythological architecture, if you will, has given us this conception of the individual, which led to life, liberty, property, 1215 Magna Carta, property leading to all of capitalism, capitalism leading to all this innovation and technology that we all enjoy. So there's a very real, unavoidable, pragmatic outcome from, even if you think Christ is just an imaginary figure, like if you think he's just purely in a figment of the imagination, it's created very...
The belief in him, you're saying, has affected, like the belief in him on some level has affected how history looks.
100%. Yeah, and you can't, I don't think we can be human without having stories or mythologies to inhabit. So if you want to look at it that way, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
I don't know, like we were talking earlier, like I have trouble with the word belief. Like, I just, if you say you believe in something, but you're not willing to bet on it, then that means nothing. It's all about action.
That's something that didn't make sense to the first century writers, like who talk about believe.
Mm.
Like, that's a fairly new way to talk about belief. To them, to believe was to act.
Right.
And this is why, I mean, the early church, I mean, Paul, all these guys, these authors, like, faith without works is dead. Like, they're basically saying this. This is James, Jesus's stepbrother, is basically like, faith without works is dead.
Yeah.
If you say you believe this, but you don't put it into practice, then it's worthless to you.
Exactly.
But what you parse out, though, this is like answering the question that we were talking about. The fact that they're inseparable doesn't mean, the fact that they're necessarily, one necessarily follows the other, doesn't mean that you can't separate them and talk about them separately.
Mm-hmm.
Because faith is, there's different ways you could describe what faith looks like, biblically speaking, but it would be like trust, dependence, and so like, and in one sense, I trust God. I trust he, and so a lot of this, we can need to kind of even go a step back, is so much of this, the basic conversations of how we even understand and how we think about what is real comes down to language. And so, because there's a lot of, that we have to be aware of presuppositional smuggling.
Mm.
So we smuggle in this idea. So one of the things that's just easy to take for granted is, okay, human language is something that just developed, that humans developed. Mm. But when you see, again, the scriptural, Hebrew Christian scriptures, the accounting is different. It's God speaks. Mm. And that in and of itself creates reality.
Mm-hmm.
It creates matter. It creates. And so then our speech is responding to God. Like we, Adam and Eve knew how to, you know, in the scripture, they knew how to respond to God somehow. In the same way, we can't logically work out how God seemingly made Adam and Eve adults. They didn't have a childhood, whatever. But in that same way, God, you know, prepackages them with the ability to communicate. And so in that conception of things, language is not something that just develops out of nowhere. It's this thing that got seeded into the world. And so because of that, then it kind of answers some of these questions of the inability of language to communicate truth and communicate meaning. If language is purely came up through human invention, then that could be true. But if language is seeded by God, then language isn't like, then language is sufficient to communicate the things that God wants to communicate. Mm. And so again, there's the difference between absolute, you know, complete knowledge and absolute or and sufficient knowledge to communicate and fulfill the things that God wants to do. So like I could say, if I were to like an exhaustive definition of where's Florida from here, you have to go and you could do this whole thing and whatever, or I could just go, it's south. And so in that way, by saying south, I'm still telling you it's true. It's not absolute, but it's sufficient to allow you to act on it. And so this is the thing that we see in the scriptures is like God, he's giving you enough information to make decisions and to bring you to the point of action.
So you talk about wrestling, and I feel like in my head, I'm thinking of like seven different ways we could take this conversation. You talk about struggling with belief today. Where's Robert Breedlove today around that conversation from kind of growing up in the church, going away from the church? I have a very similar story growing up in the church. My grandfather was a pastor. Like the kind of pastor that he thinks that you should drive a Bentley. Like if you give me $100, God will give you a Bentley. Like this, it was a whole Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And getting to college and then by God's grace, every single one of my friends was like an evangelistic atheist. Like it wasn't enough for them to be an atheist. Like I needed to be an atheist too, because that was truth to them. And so I wrestled through that for 2 years, kind of this very much deconstructing down to zero and then rebuilding from there of like, okay, but then coming back to the fundamental question of, what actually is true, right? I have no truth now that I kind of have, like for me, no sort of like identifying truth, and now what is truth, and then kind of rebuilding from there. So walking through your story, you say today, you know, in October, where are you with all that as you're kind of wrestling through it?
Yeah, well, wrestling right now out loud with you guys.
Yeah.
So I'll say a number of things about it. Just to finish the thought originally that Christ is, again, regardless of historical truth, theological truth, doesn't matter. He's the reason we have private property rights. And had there been no Christ, there would have not been any private property rights. We would not have been a part of our mythological substructure that became part of our legal structure that became part of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So again, private property rights, the basis of civilization, like Christ is intrinsic to that. So there's no materialist reductionist argument against him at that point. I'm like, what can you say? There's nothing you can say, especially if you're tweeting it or doing something on some piece of sophisticated technology that was born by capitalism, that was protected by, you know, all of these codes that originated with Christ. So there's a very, I guess my point there is extremely pragmatic, useful, real. I don't see how you really argue your way around it unless you just want to dispute that Christ didn't contribute to the formation of private property rights as a concept, something we embody, by the way, right? We act as if you have private property rights. It doesn't actually exist. You don't actually have the exclusive right to the things that you say you own.
Yep.
Anyone can come and steal them and violate them and take them. But if we all pretend that that's true, which we more or less have done, you know, better in some periods than others. We've created this real abundance, this material abundance from capitalism. So that's one thing, just to finish that one thought. Where I am at specifically in my own relationship with Christ is, I've always loved Peterson's answer. They say, do you believe in God? Mm-hmm. And he says, no, but I act as if he exists. Mm-hmm. Again, dispensing with belief and putting the primacy on action. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't so much care if I meet someone and they say, I don't believe in God, but they're a very morally integrated, you know, good, wholesome person, then I'm going to accord well with that individual. I'm not so concerned with what specific conception they have for themselves in the world. So for me, I guess my approximate answer that I'm trying to just live out. I don't, it's just a thing to say it, but I'm actually trying to live it out to the best of my abilities, to just be a disciple of Christ, right? To try and discipline yourself around the life that he led to be more like him.
Yeah.
Again, in that sequence of abstracting things out of stories, another way to look at Christ is just like the perfect human consciousness. Mm-hmm. So again, even whether you exist or not, you can model yourself after that.
Yeah.
So that's a thing. And then I would also like to get into the etymology of the word God. Mm-hmm. One of the roots that we trace into the Proto-Indo-European language was the word G-H-U-T, Gut. This word has four meanings, a couple of which are really relevant. One is to barter or exchange, and one is to return. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about God speaking reality into existence, and then I see the etymological root of the word God in this phenomenon called exchange, mm-hmm. and we also understand that action is very primary for human beings, it's like every action is exchange at the same time, right?
Yep.
Newton knew this, right? Every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah, everything is relational.
Everything is relational. All identity is intertwined. This is, you know, the root word of rationality is, you know, ratio, to set two things in contrast and compare them against each other. Mm-hmm. This is the bedrock of knowledge, I guess, at least reducible knowledge. And so that seems interesting to me, that there's some, it's almost like we think thing one and thing two interact and exchange with one another, but it seems like the truth is inverse to that. It's like thing one and thing two exist because an exchange occurred, mm-hmm. right? There's the relationship is primary somehow, which is a real kind of trip to think about. And so what was the last thing I was going to say about this? I forgot the last one, but the idea, when you get into the primacy of relationship and exchange, obviously that has some connections over to economics, mm-hmm. where we talk about, hey, the more consensual you can make exchange,
yep.
the more wealth we actually create. Mm-hmm. So, and this herein lies my real emphasis on freedom. Mm-hmm. It's about free markets, mutually consensual yeah. behavior, the removal of coercion. Like, I think that's what creates the best outcomes in the world, and that's very aligned with the yeah. Christian mythos.
And one of the things, again, so one of the kind of questions is, so when I think about the idea of private property rights, like I my initial thought goes to the Ten Commandments, because like one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not steal. If you don't have private rights, then stealing, the idea of stealing makes no sense. Like you can't steal something that belongs to you. And so I even go there. There's been a lot, like, so one of my favorite professors from college is writing this book about the politics of ancient Israel and about how like revolutionary it was in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, so God gives Israel this land that was belonging to these people who were sacrificing children, these like horribly, like these were not great people. And God gives them this land, divides it up among, divides the land so that every single family has land. And then boom. So he like hardwires this, boom, you go from there. And just the genius involved in this, like you could loan, like let's say something, again, things happen. You could loan out you could loan out your property or sell yourself as a slave, sell your property to someone. But every certain period of time, like every 7 years, like they restored your private rights. It accounts for things happen to me and I need to deal with, but I'm still not going to lose this land. I'm not going to lose this. That is going to allow my family, you know, to flourish for generations. It was this very incredibly low time preference decision on the part of God to think about what is going to produce human flourishing. And so land was implicit in that. Obviously money is incredibly useful. It's an incredibly useful tool. And both the feature and bug of money is that it abstracts. And one of the things with, if you have sound money that's coming from the actual world that exists, then it's not so much of an abstraction. Fiat money is a complete abstraction. This is not tying to real life at all.
It's faith without works.
Yeah. It's just this again, it's not, and this is where, you know, we as Christians like have issues with this, is because you're not, fiat money does not depend on and does not acknowledge and appreciate the world that God has actually made in the way that he's designed it to work. And so we've talked about it, like one of the things that comes up a lot in my mind is, so there's this, from beginning to the end of the scriptures is this idea of sowing and reaping. And so you have, you know, God gives to each one according to his works. Like God is very much about proof of work. Like what you do matters incredibly. There's a cost to it, good, bad, you know, ugly, whatever. There's a cost to it. And so you can go throughout the whole Bible, but there's a, you see this repeated in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul, he says, God is not mocked, for what a man sows, he will also reap. And so to me, again, being in the, I was going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and I see this and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. This idea of sowing and reaping and fiat money not complying to that is not just some tangential, not very important thing. This is at the heart of, like, by believing that there's no relationship between sowing and reaping, consequence and action, whatever, you're mocking God. You're making a mockery of every other thing, every other process, relationships that we have with people, relationships that you have with your wife. Everything else operates under this principle.
The exchange. So again, you were talking about the importance of language earlier, right? Mm-hmm. It's where, okay, I can't tell you exactly how to get to Florida, but yeah, if I say south, it's true enough,
it's
right?
Useful.
Right. Yeah. It's and we call the American pragmatist called these pragmatic truths, right? It's, you can never get maybe absolute truth contained in a word. I guess God would be the closest thing we can come to that.
Yeah.
For Christians, at least, there's other traditions that have different, a word, right? A Tao or Dharma,
something,
whatever.
Yep.
But ultimately, language itself, I think it's an interesting word because you're basically making a real strong argument for language, right? That it's something that's super human, right? It's something we have learned or attuned to in reality rather than something we just invented ourselves.
Yep.
And so when I look at words, right, it's a language, that's the language we're accustomed to.
Yeah.
They're media of exchange. It's a medium we're using to exchange things, particularly data, right? I've got a worldview or a model. I can put that into this psychotechnological thing called literacy, send it across the airwaves to you. And because you're running the same software, you can interpret that word and know that I meant bird, right?
Yep.
With the word bird, something like that. So words are media of exchange for intention, perception, observation, something like that, perhaps, where I'm just converting my sense experience into something that I've thought up to share with you,
to
share back and forth. And by the way, when two nodes connect, right, we become dialogical. We can think more. We produce more thoughts together than we do apart, again, back to the primacy relationship.
Yes.
And so you say all that to bridge it into money. It's like, oh, well, so if words are just a medium of exchange, that's also what money is.
Yes.
But money seems to be a more significant language. I don't know. There's trade-offs. To say something with money is to say something much louder, right? If you put $1 million into a project, this is the old adage, actions speak louder than words, right? To do something is louder than to say something, in the same way that I think acting, it matters more than belief, as we said earlier. To put capital at risk, right? You presumably accumulated that capital through many, 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 many actions.
Yeah. Yep.
So I would argue that capital speaks even louder than actions, which speak even louder than words. So money, if you're talking about the importance of language, it's just one of the most important languages in the sphere of human affairs.
Yeah, it communicates axiological truth. Like
right.
Truth, axiological is value.
Like, and so to your point, like inverting sowing and reaping, if we establish a debt-based money, which is oxymoronic in many ways,
right,
one of the definitions of money is that which extinguishes debt.
Yeah.
But if you have money that is intrinsically debt-based, then you're like kind of left scratching your head. Like, what? This is not really money. It's pseudo money. But it leads to and incentivizes the inversion of reaping and sowing as well, right?
Yep.
You, on a fiat currency standard, you're incentivized to accumulate more debt, to consume more, to not think about the future.
Yep.
And so I'm very fascinated with this deep interpenetrating pattern of action between how the tool is structured and how, or the mythological system is built and you pour human beings into it.
Yeah.
And the human nature just sort of responds to the incentives.
Yeah.
It's not like, I don't see people as static, good or evil, good or bad. I look at people as, and their characters, like your shirts, it's sound money for sound men.
Yeah.
I think individual characters are emergent properties of the incentive schemas they inhabit.
Yep. So we were just at this conference, this Christian conference over in Knoxville. We chose that to be our first Christian event because the denomination and the people who are there, they already have. So that's those are the groups. That's the group of people that Gary North was a part of. That's like his tribe. So they already get, yeah. So they already get the sound money side of things. So we didn't even have to. And the normal pitch with Christians is, this is why sound money matters. Bitcoin is sound money. With them, we just got to skip step one. You know, these are already gold bugs. These are silver people. But one of the guys who spoke, he's a pastor. His name is Douglas Wilson. And he repeated this Chesterton quote: "We shape our buildings and then our buildings shape us."
Yeah, I've heard that one.
I was like, this is exactly true of money. Mm-hmm. Like, we shape our money and then our money shapes us. It's this feedback mechanism of decisions that have been made about what our money will look like and what the priorities that are involved in it. One of the things that we were talking about was, again, going back to language. So again, you have language in the beginning, like God speaks. It's literally the mechanism he uses to create everything. He speaks and then, except for people, he actually forms people. But everything else, he speaks and it comes into being. Reality leaps to, you know, answer and obey. And then you go to something like the Tower of Babel, where everyone up to that point speaks this common language, and then God acts, and all of a sudden there's all these new languages that exist. Mm. And so there's very much that. But if you go even deeper, we know for the last 50 years, humans have been able to access insight into the nature of language that really is even more penetrating than anybody else in human history could even have accessed. And that's because we can go, in the last 50 years, we've been able to venture inside of the cells that form and create every living thing. And when we go down into these cells, what you find is language. Mm-hmm. Humans are coded beings. Everything, like life is coded.
Right.
Like if everything around here was just, you know, these dead, whatever, we were composed of these dead things, like that would be one thing, but it's information.
Yes.
And so in the same way that if we went out and found, when they found the Rosetta Stone, none of these people who found it were like, oh yeah, this just happened. And why is that? Because we know, like, there's a coordinated, you know, there's patterns there. There's all these things. And so they inherently knew that this was, somebody had written this, somebody had taken the things and they'd done that. And the interesting thing is, well, then how in the, like, why isn't that the same reflex when we go into ourselves and we find out that we can pattern, we can, you know, weed out certain genes in order to produce these kind of ends. Like if in every other area of human life, we find information and, you know, coded, organized information, we know that there was a designer behind it. Why do we think differently when it comes to finding DNA and code within ourselves? So anyhow,
it's a great way to look at it. And there's, and here's also where you can maybe bridge science and religion too, because a guy like Richard Dawkins describes genetic beings, of which we are one. Mm-hmm. He calls them digital rivers, actually. Mm-hmm. So genetics, they're digital information.
Yeah.
They have some analog components too, which he goes into, but we're digital creatures, frankly. And he talks about how that's information flowing through time. Mm. So like you're basically, each one of us is a carrier, a vehicle for genetic information.
Yeah.
We're not, we think we are individually thinking and acting on our own behalf, but technically it's the genes telling us what to do. Mm-hmm. And this gets into a lot of, you know, just Darwinian reproductive theory and all that. Mm-hmm. But when a being will then, that river of digital information can separate in time, right? If two species become separated on a different island, then they'll evolve differently. Mm-hmm. So there's this, it's interesting that it is language all the way down to its core, but it's also digital, like even in the digital age, the codes that we're now messing with, obviously it's having a big impact on biology, right? Where the CRISPR projects and cloning, all these things. We finally developed a sufficiently complex tool that's almost as complex as us. So it's giving us, again, with this feedback, right? We get more insights into how we actually are.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to me that at bottom, there's language.
Yeah.
Now, I think something you said, that you said language presupposes a designer. Mm-hmm. Now, the biologists would push back against that, 100%. Right? And they'd say, no, you can run an algorithm and have a design without a designer.
Who can run an algorithm?
Well, they're saying that life is that algorithm. It's just that it's a genetic search algorithm propagating through blood, flesh, bone, and it's just searching for new designs to be fit to the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that to me presupposes purpose or teleology.
Yeah.
They would say, no, evolution is blind. It's not that. I think it's pointed at freedom, like that toward a larger option space. But again, I, all of these arguments, I think, ultimately ground out in the insufficiency of language. I just don't think our language, English language specifically, not language maybe as such, but we are trying to communicate these ideas that are just more complex than we understand. But it's interesting to me how that gap gets closed as our technological realities become more advanced. Mm-hmm. It's like as we create new tech, so we develop new language around it, we're that much closer to explaining that, which is unexplainable.
The issue that I have is, so
I'm just watching. I'm just watching you guys go through.
The issue that I have, again, it's one thing for scientists to have, and obviously to take issue with that, but you can't, the issue that they take is not a scientific argument. It's a philosophical argument.
Right.
And so in that sense, okay, so you're acknowledging, like, this scientist, again, I have zero problem with any science. Like, but again, the issue that what you're doing at that point is we're having a philosophical debate that's not evidential. Mm-hmm. It's not a material debate that we can't go to material evidences and demonstrate this. And so, but again, it's due in large part to breaking down people's strengths. So we silo and atomize specialization. This is what we have, specialization. And so somebody who is very talented in science is not necessarily very talented in philosophy and understanding. And so you need these bridging points. You need people who are able to both process the philosophical arguments and the scientific things to be able to measure, wait a second, rather than being stuck in this room by myself or in my closed loop, like this makes sense in my closed loop, but the philosophy guy, this is why they killed Plato, Socrates. Yeah, that's why they killed Socrates, because Socrates is asking too many questions that are causing problems for the
corrupting the youth.
Yeah, corrupting the youth. They had pragmatic issues with what's going on. And I think that's part of the question that I would have. So there's lots of things that are pragmatically useful over a given time scale that are still horribly immoral. And we can look back now and go, hey, we have a lot of data. And we have a ton of data that we wouldn't have had otherwise, because there wasn't anybody else barbaric enough to do a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. But the question is, so yes, it's pragmatically useful, but that's not enough. We operate under the belief that there are moral principles that prevent us from getting certain types of knowledge.
I agree with you completely. And I put it this way, though. The hardcore materialist reductionists have a problem with this. They think science can have all the answers or contain all the knowledge.
That's a presupposition.
Or that it's somehow superordinate to human systems in a way, right? Like we're tapping into something that's beyond ourselves, but it's not ultimately. Science is premised on faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of scientists hate this.
They hate that idea, but
it's Plato, right? It's fundamentally true that the only way you can engage in the scientific enterprise and have empirically formulated experiments is to have faith that intelligibility will track the contours of reality. So every time what you're doing in empirical science, right, you're testing to see if something happens, you're then taking notes between hypothesis and outcome.
Yeah.
And you're always assuming, though, that nature is not going to pull a fast one on you.
Yes,
right?
100%.
It's not going to like let water freeze at zero this time and then be -5 next time just to throw you for a loop. You have faith that the structures of intelligibility will always track the structures of reality to do science.
And you can't demonstrate that scientifically.
Yeah. So this is where I'm back to that importance of mythologies, is that we have to create these stories, right? Science itself is just a story, just another mythology. Very useful in a lot of ways, and that it eliminates a lot of subjectivity and gives us a very tight objective grip on the world. But there are things, including its foundational assumptions, that cannot be proven scientifically.
You bring it back down to, you bring it back down to Bitcoin. So there are tools. We create tools.
Yes.
The tool is fashioned towards a certain end. I have a problem, and so I fashion a tool to, you know, to solve that problem. And science does that. Science solves a lot of things within the material world. It's designed to do that. And it does that incredibly well, but the material world does not all exist. Many of, even today, there's tons of scientists who are Christians. I mean, many of the greatest minds in science have been Christians. They did not see these things in tension whatsoever. They're saying God has purposes in the world, and so we're going to investigate these things so that people will benefit from them, but never operating under the belief that these things are an end of, in and of themselves, which is the thing you run into. The question is, what is the end for which science is created? What is the end for which economics?
But science cannot answer that question.
And they can't. Right. They can't. You have to have something else grounding that.
So, so two things that I'm sort of thinking about, just sort of in reference to this conversation, but also into the time of kind of what we have to talk. I can speak practically from my side of the story, sort of as I'm listening to you guys sort of discuss all these things. I think for me practically, as I mentioned earlier, Christian, college, atheist, professing atheist, I don't believe these things anymore. Time passes. I start to ask the question, but why? I start to ask purpose questions, right? And then I start reading Kierkegaard, Gandhi, the Quran, anything I get my hands on, I'm just devouring it, right? Well, one of those things is the Bible. One of those things is Jesus. And what I would sort of say in light of what you're saying and sort of this conversation at large is we see this entire myth that we're talking about, this kind of entire story of, hey, this is important. And for me, what really changed was I went directly to the person of Jesus. Because that to me is you mentioned like he could not have existed. The historicity doesn't really matter. And I would sort of push back and say that to me, that was the whole thing. If Jesus is who he says he is, all of those other questions become totally different conversations. If he's not who he says he is, I'm back to square one around why am I here?
I don't want
to
say that doesn't matter. I just want to say it's not relevant to private property rights.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Story exists, and that's all you need for private property rights to exist.
Yeah.
I'm not, I'm just trying to put all that.
Yeah, you're answering one question.
Yes. 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 Exactly. And so for me, it was really about that, because when people ask me, well, does God exist? Like, that feels like such a harder question to answer, just sort of out here in this kind of like looking at the world around.
Which God are we talking about?
Like, yes.
There's all kinds of.
And so for me, it was coming back to this person who either existed or did it, and read it, you know, and that's, to me, that was it was building from there. That being said, sort of kind of coming back to, you mentioned earlier going to this conference, something we were talking about before we started recording, is here we are at this conference, and this is sort of what I want to pick your brain on. Here we are at this conference. I'm surprised at how many people are way closer than I thought they would be to the Bitcoin conversation. And again, you have the podcast, What is Money, right? So we're sitting with these people who are like, totally agree with you guys, you know, and the Fed. And I'm like, so do you own Bitcoin? They're like, no. Right? And I'm like, wait, how did...
Are you buying gold? And some get, no. Yeah. And we're like, well...
And so for a lot of them, it was this thing of, well, what's the end game there? Like that was something that was I told him in the middle of the conference, like, we can't let people walk away from the table saying, yes, we agree with you, but we're doing nothing about it. Like, how insane is that? You know what I mean? Right. But from your perspective, how do we have that conversation? Here we are sitting across the table from Christians who are like, at least close.
Yeah.
You know,
so these are,
yeah, what would you say to Christians in terms of why they should spend more time thinking about this, or, you know, what is money in more generally? Like, what?
Well, so it sounds like your audience were Gary North followers, right? They had read his books, and presumably
a lot of them. Yeah.
Some were, I assume if you're reading Gary North and following his work, you have to be a gold bug to some extent. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy's very was, he's late and great. He just passed a year ago.
I think a little bit.
Phenomenal author. You know, his book, Honest Money, actually is where I was inspired by the five properties of money. So he's the one, it's kind of ironic because I think Jimmy emailed him later on after we had written the book, and Gary North was like anti-Bitcoin, but I would chalk that up to age.
Yeah.
This is a push of 90.
I'll just say real quick, we joked, the thing that I kept saying to people was, have you guys seen the Star Trek meme where it's the girl and she asks, are you two friends? And then there's like the two guys, the one says yes, the one says no. We're the one, the Bitcoiners are the ones saying yes, we're friends with Gary North, and he's the one saying no, I'm not.
Right, 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 exactly. But so he breaks, you know, five properties of good money: divisibility, durability, recognizability, portability, scarcity. So I think if you, especially if you have that audience, like hopefully they've read that book and it's like you already own gold, you see the value in honest money or money independent of the state, just, you know, honest weights and measures, mm-hmm. like all of, to get more into the Christian side of it. But if you can get them to Gary's five properties of money, it's like, okay, gold became money because it best satisfied those things. You know, the first four kind of metals did, but then scarcity, gold had the most inflexible supply, which means it's the one money that's least counterfeitable over time, which means it's the best store of value over time, which means it becomes the preferred repository for all this economic residual energy we create, yep. the division of labor. It's like, yep. people pick gold for that. Okay, so that process, that free market consensual strapping process, favors gold or selects gold. In the same way that markets discover prices, right? Markets also discover tools. Mm. Like, what tool is best for the job? Well, gold was best for the job over time. Why? Because it best satisfied these properties, yep. of money. So if you get all that, you can get that into someone's head. And that's, I just did that in 2 minutes. But we'll spend 200 hours talking about that on the show. So it's not an easy lift necessarily. But if you can get them that perspective and then just ask the question, okay, so you know what money is, pretty much, like it's the thing that best does these properties best.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at Bitcoin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the most divisible, most durable, most recognizable, most portable, and infinitely perfectly scarce, only perfectly scarce asset we've ever had. Mm-hmm. And so, and I could run through that in detail if you guys like, well, but I've talked about it a lot.
I think they're there, right? And then I'm kind of framing the conversations that we had. Well, yeah, but gold has value. It's intrinsic. Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. You know, like their next thing is they just can't bridge that gap between, well, gold is real.
Right.
Right.
Tangible.
It's tangible. Right. And they might even not even use the word tangible because they're trying, they're like, I understand it's digital, but it's more like, but gold is like, this is intrinsically, and it's like, well, no, it has that because of those properties you just listed.
100%. And then I get very upset with the term intrinsic value, people that use it, because again, it's just a testament to us living through the economic dark ages that we're currently in. We've known intrinsic value is total bullshit since the 1850s. That's what the marginalism revolution was. They used to think, oh, this water bottle has 60 utils in it. This table has 75. And that's why they traded this exchange ratio on the market. Like, we thought value was some objective fundamental article. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of economists were like, no, it's all preference. Like, you choose things at the margin. And that selection process is what establishes market pricing. So we've known that for almost 200 years now. However, the Keynesian indoctrination has thoroughly suppressed the suffusion of that idea into the marketplace. So when people bring up the intrinsic value argument, I'm like, okay, let's just destroy this real quick. And then once you get that one out, you can go back into, okay, so what do people actually value? Well, they value outcomes. And outcomes are associated with properties of an asset, right? A water bottle, I want it to be rigid. I want it to be symmetrical. I want it to have a good volume. I want it to keep the temperature of my beverage over a certain expectancy, right?
Yep.
I value the properties this water bottle has because I expect certain outcomes to come from it.
Mm.
That's how I assign value to an asset. Yeah. And when it comes to money, you want the divisible, durable, recognizable, portable, and scarce asset. So if you... I think that's the best way to think about it. And that to me is, that's the central axis of the What Is Money show.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so we're figuring out what is money. We're sitting with these people. We're talking about these things. A lot of them sit down with us and say, all right, tell me what the next step is, right? So when you get someone to that kind of cliff and they're like, okay, like I got you. I'm in, I'm not going to like sell my house and buy Bitcoin, but like, what are my next steps?
It's a great question. And I guess I never advocate for anyone to buy Bitcoin other than sometimes I'll say buy just a little bit. Like you just buy a few bucks just so you can like touch it and interact with it, thinking about it. Yeah. Something that's not a consequential amount of money. I would say to just do that for most people because what is there to lose, right?
Yeah. Like
skip your next coffee and buy $5 in Bitcoin, whatever. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I don't advocate for people buying Bitcoin. I always advocate for people studying, right? Developing a worldview, listening to these podcasts, reading these books, like go and figure it out for yourself. And then after you've constructed a worldview, create a portfolio that matches that, right? That's what's going to give you the conviction to hold the assets in your portfolio. Because if you just buy something because Gordon told you to buy something and you don't understand it, and then the price goes down 30%.
I will not apologize for it or tell you my fails.
You're going to sell it emotionally. So I always try to lead with that, like education. You know, people are always giving advice, saying this is not financial advice. Well, I think establish a worldview and make a portfolio, construct a portfolio that reflects that. I consider that to be financial advice and I like to give out. Now, assuming you've done all that and you're still orange-pilled and you want to buy some Bitcoin, I would just tell people, you know, automatic buy and withdrawal to cold storage, geographically distributed multi-sig, which we're now apparently calling multi-key because multi-sig sounded too intimidating.
Yeah.
Just means using multiple keys to store one sack of Bitcoin so you get redundancy. You know, like that's all I do is I have daily automatic recurring buy. It hits a certain threshold. I go through Swan. Hits a certain threshold. It withdraws to my multi-sig. And then I buy opportunistically on price dips. I stay profitable as an individual, right? I spend less than I generate in terms of revenue and accumulate some dollars that I gradually turn into BTC over time, plus pay for my life. And it's really one of the most liberating peace of mind giving things I've ever done. Versus chasing all these projects around in the stock market and try to do these complex options of derivative plays that just pull you a thousand different directions. High risk, high reward. It's just so simple.
It's a time suck. It's emotional suck.
And you outperform. This strategy, just buy, accumulate Bitcoin and hold it forever. It outperforms every other strategy. I mean, that might not be exactly perfectly true, but I'm talking 99.9% of all hedge funds, everything.
One of the things there, again, this is one of the things that makes me think about is something like marriage, which like marriage is this buy and hold. It's this, you're faithful. Like you just keep faithfully doing it through thick and thin. You just show up. And it's an imperfect example, but it is very similar. There's ups and downs. There's all these things. There's benefits. There's hard days. There's great days. There's bull markets. There's bear markets. If you look at the sociological experiments, they do all the kind of, you know, like who are the happiest people, who are the whatever. And it's these people who, you know, are, you know, they're married, they have kids, whatever. Yeah. The hodlers. Exactly.
And I think that's been fun, even in my Bitcoin journey. If I'm right, that's sort of my go-to. If I'm right about this, and I kind of work through, like, if I'm right about Jesus, and if I'm right about Bitcoin, right? Like, there, then Bitcoin is a good gift from God, right? Like, let's follow there. Once I get there, it's like there is this beautiful symbolism, like God's fingerprints are. You can notice them, like when you begin to. When you become aware of who God is, you can see these things in the good gifts that he gives us, that it's like, that's the interesting thing at this Christian conference is not trying to come across as like some crazy cultist where I'm like, Bitcoin's everything. But when you catch a glimpse of truth, it's very undeniable, right? It's seeing these kind of, again, this idea, he talked about it so much at the conference, the idea of sowing and reaping, right? Yeah. And it's like, the more I fleshed out of my head, it's like, people who get to print money think they're God. They get to create something out of nothing.
Create false realities.
Yes, too. Exactly.
Wokeism, all the stuff we're seeing in the world, these are false realities being spun up by stolen money.
Yeah, subsidized by stolen money.
Yep, exactly. That the market wouldn't normally choose.
Right. The market is actively rejecting, actually. You see the wokeism going into these Netflix films and all that, and the market's just poo-pooing them.
And that's the...
I just think sowing and reaping is designed to be this. God designed it as a way for you to be blessed for obedience and blessed for submitting yourself, humble yourself to the reality of the way the world is designed.
That's true,
The more you submit yourself to it, the more freedom and the more, you know, the more benefit you get from it.
This reminds me of I think Francis Bacon, maybe, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. Like to humble yourself before nature and adapt to it, right? That's how we actually make our lives better. So we had this we've had this notion of kind of conquering and subduing nature, which we do to some extent, but if you do it incorrectly, that yes. just it blows back in your face. I want to flesh out one more idea.
Do it.
So this idea of the absolute. So the absolute is, I mean, it's another one of those words. It's kind of like one step towards transcendence or right at the borderline somewhere. It's that which is unchanging, unchangeable, immutable, right? Versus the relative, which is everything that's part of worldly experience, right? Like perception itself is almost relativistic, right? Like we're comparing like size and shape and depth, all these things, like your depth perception is a relative thing. So, and one of the weird things I learned about this is these are not diametrically opposed as you might actually believe, but for the absolute to actually be absolute, it has to be all encompassing. So it has to actually include the relative, but the relative cannot include the absolute. So there's a very interesting rigorous philosophical line of argumentation down that path. But so when I look at humans and I say, okay, what is unchanging, unchangeable, immutable, and the actual human being, human development? And I think one of them, there might be more, but agape certainly seems to be one of these things. And so the Greeks had at least three words for love, right? Eros is consumptive love. I love the bag of potato chips. No, I love the steak. I want to eat the steak.
Well done.
There's philia, which is reciprocal love, right? You want an ongoing opening with your friends and family and lovers, right? You don't want to consume them, hopefully. You just want to get to know them better. You want them to get to know you better. That's that form of love. And then finally is agape, which is the ultimate love, right? When you bring your new child home from just being born, they're just an inert lump. You don't even really have much reciprocity in that engagement, but yet it's the most overwhelming, ineffable form of love we can experience. So I look at human development and say, one interesting thing about us is that we have this huge neocortex, right? That lets us, plan and generate all these long-term plans and deal with large spatial realities, communicate via language and all this. It's what gives us the power to be this animal that plays with mythologies or plays in the world of imagination. It lets us be dominant in the world, right? This gets into like Yuval Harari's book, Sapiens, which he talked about humans being the animal that tells story, that we are the only species that can cooperate flexibly in large numbers. And that's why we run the world. So he says, you can unite 10,000 Christians under a flag. You can't do that with apes, right? And it's that reason that's why we run, that's why we're at the top of the food chain, basically. So, but one of the costs of that is that humans have to be born very early, right? Like a lot of animals are born and they just get up and walk, right? And humans don't walk for first 9 months, a year, whatever it is. So we have to come into the world much more vulnerable than most other species as a consequence of this thing that lets us be top of the food chain. So what does that imply? That implies that this is the case. A human cannot reach adulthood without receiving agape from at least one person. Someone has to love infant you, right? For many, many months and take risk with you and feed you and spend time and energy and invest for you to even be able to get up and walk initially, right? Much less do anything else to take care of yourself. So humans have this extended developmental process, which is the cost of our, extraordinary cognitive development relative to other animals. And so that's like biologically an absolute, that you have to have agape to be, if you are a living adult, it's one thing we all share. I don't know how you could really argue around it other than maybe someone got stuck in an incubator that helped them survive.
Yeah. But even
that would be some form of agape, right? Yeah. Someone built you that incubator and stuck you in there. So I think the Christian story, that's central to the story of Christ. And again, if we have to inhabit these mythologies and we have to live in these stories, it makes sense that they should be imbued with the most timeless truths And so I just think this is a very interesting connection that there's a biological necessity to agape that that's also the core, a core pillar to the Christian.
Absolutely. So there's obviously the physical, you just described about the physical, the biological reality. And then there, but then there's also the spiritual reality. So the verse that popped into my head was Jesus. He says, unless you become like a child. And he had this little child who brings him up on his lap. He says, unless you become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. And so he's basically saying, unless you learn to depend on me, depend on God, the way that a little child does, you can't be part of it. That is what it is to be human, is to lean on God and depend on him. I mean, that's just...
It makes me think of in Genesis, when God says, let us make man in our image. Like this idea of God existing in relationship, right? From the beginning of time, from before time, him communicating that, like that sort of, you know, reciprocal, relational sort of agape love, it underpins all of everything.
A lot of people have like an idea of like God as this solo person existing from eternity past. Like that's even many Christians like have that conception. It, when they think about it, they think of God as this solo figure back then.
Guy in the sky.
Yeah. No. And so, but when you delve deeper, like theologians, when theologians lay this out, it's like, no. They're the Trinity. You have the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They're existing from eternity past. And they're living in this perfect fellowship, triune fellowship with each other. So it's not just a one-way street. It's they're interacting with each other. They're communicating. They're changing one another.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a term that's called the way of discussing the different roles of the Trinity. It's called the economic Trinity.
Hmm.
And so they're from eternity past, they have this relationship with each other. And so the creation of the world is not, it's not this God was bored and lonely, and so he created somebody to be his companion. It's in the same way as, you know, the same way as children come forth. Children, generally are born within a family that is they are the fruit of this loving relationship. And so they are this, it's this excess, the excess love and the excess joy that is
overflow.
It's the overflow. Children are designed to be the overflow. And so very much like that, that's what God paints humans as.
Right.
Like we are the overflow of his power, his creativity, his love, and his action, his mission mindedness. So we have that. And then you have Jesus. How does Jesus teach us to pray? He says, our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. May your name be set apart in our minds. Your kingdom come, your will be done. How? On earth as it is in heaven. And so what is Jesus is saying, he's like, we're the artist who's drawing, and then he looks over at his muse, and then he looks back and he starts drawing, and looks back at his muse and he keeps drawing. And so Jesus is saying, this is how we live our lives. Mm-hmm. We take a look at the original, and then we go back and we try to imitate that in our lives. Then we look there again. Christians, we organize ourselves at least once a week. We go to church. We see who God is and what he's doing. And then we go back and we imitate it. And so it's this constant process of growing and looking and then coming back and then going out and then coming back, expanding and sharing what we're learning and then coming back, gathering together. It's this constant, the same way as we eat and then we go away and we work and then we come back to eat so that we can work more. It's a very similar dynamic going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, this what came up for me there. The Neoplatonic term is the procession and the reversion. Mm. Right, there's always the going out, but then there's back. And you know, Kit, I love that term, the overflow, because that was there's a book titled Theophany by Eric Pearl. It's really good. It goes into the Neoplatonic philosophy that was a lot of it developing the conception of God that preceded even publishing of the Bible, right? So there was, again, wrestling with this idea of God. And one of the descriptions was, it's the basis for all being. So it's not any being, mm-hmm. not any individual being.
Yep.
God is foundational to all being itself. And also describing how it creates overflow, right? And it's through love that creates overflow. So you mentioned people coming together to have kids, children are the overflow. I think that, so man and woman coming together to have kids, that is the primary market for human beings, right? That's actually the only market.
The only market, care yeah. About
yeah. Is two people consensually finding each other to have children and be a family.
Yeah.
That's the only market that actually matters.
Yeah.
All these other markets
yeah.
Exist to serve that market.
100%.
So we know you would never have, and we have had this historically, right? Marriage wasn't always mutually consensual.
Yep.
There were a lot of arranged marriages, yep. A lot of coercion, et cetera, for you know different
reasons, yeah.
Different planning purposes, let's say, for states and kingdoms and all that. But now our evolved view, at least in the West, is you know people get to choose who they're going to marry and have kids with. So we've taken consent to be one of the highest values in that primary market, which is the market of making kids. Yet the markets that serve that market, economic markets of trade, goods and services, we don't have full consent mm-hmm. embedded in those markets. Mm-hmm. Fiat currency being
yep.
One of the huge problems.
Yep.
That there's an instrument that's used to steal from market participants all the time, everywhere, and also erect new barriers to trade, like
yep.
Regulation, taxation, capital controls, all of this.
Yep.
So I guess that just is one sort of spiritual aim I would like. It's like, okay, look, guys, we figured out that consent really matters in making people, making happy, sustainable families. Mm-hmm. Let's just abstract that principle to general market trade. Mm-hmm. The more consent we have, the less coercion we have, the more wealth we create,
mm-hmm.
yeah. The more we increase the carrying capacity of the planet.
Yeah.
And if we are to be fruitful and multiply, how yep. Else could you do that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The idea of consent, or the idea of, you could describe it a little bit touch differently, but like reason. It's like one of the things we tend to assume, like God is he's this dominant figure who's just sitting here throwing down lightning bolts to make sure that his will gets done. He's this angry guy in the sky, which is, you get Zeus is pictured, capricious, he's in it for himself. But, and God is holy. He is painted as being holy, and he cares about injustice, and he acts to defend the weak and punish injustice at different points. But there's a point, I believe it's in the book of either Jeremiah or Isaiah, where God, his people have wandered into sin. They're worshiping the idols of countries that basically enslaved them. And God just go to them and say, I'm going to wipe you out. Mm. He says, come, let us reason together.
Mm.
Though your sins be as scarlet, I will make them white as snow. And so he's appealing to them and trying to reason with them rather than just dominating them. Right. And then Paul talks about one of his critiques of the pagans. He describes them as being like unreasoning animals. Mm. And so he's drawing this distinction between humans and animals. It's, you know, humans, God has given them reason to be able to process. So we're not just driven by our impulses, our physical desires. We plot out and methodologically think about, okay, how can I have my needs met? Not only that, how can I meet the needs of others on a scale that is insane to right. Think about?
The economist language of economics would say humans act.
Yeah. Right?
They have purposeful yep. Use of means to achieve ends,
yep.
Whereas we look at animals being much more instinctual or yep. Behavioral. They're not reprogramming themselves to yep. Achieve new ends. They're yep. Just repeating
yeah.
Yep. Done. So
yeah.
Thanks for your
time. It's been an awesome conversation. Robert, where can people find you that want to find out more, especially like the What Is Money podcast?
Yeah, so you can go to whatismoneypodcast.com. That's got links to all our RSS feeds, YouTube channel, etc. We're on YouTube and pretty much anywhere that you listen to podcasts. You can also find me on Twitter at breedlove22. That's BREEDLOVE22. There's a link to my link tree there, which has links to our book and all the other things that I've worked on.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me,
guys. I think this is like the start of a few more conversations. I got more questions.
Yeah.
Happy to do it.
Thanks, Robert.